Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to an Empire Podcast interview special. K-pop Demon Hunters was, quite simply, one of the biggest movie phenomenons of last year. An animated movie about Huntrix, a K-pop girl group who, well, hunt demons. It debuted on Netflix last June without much fanfare, just another movie seemingly destined to be lost in the shuffle. But then, something funny happened. It found an audience, beguiled by its blend of cracking action, humor, heart, and tunes. And then that audience began to grow, and grow, and grow. A couple of months after it launched, a sing-along version was released in cinemas for one weekend only and did boffo box office, as they say. The soundtrack album has dominated the charts for months, while Golden, one of the songs from the movie, hit number one in the UK. And the Netflix records began to fall. First, it became the company's most watched original movie. It began life as a Sony Pictures animation film, although it became a Netflix property around 2021 while it was still in production. And then, Netflix's most watched property ever. Time magazine hailed it as a breakthrough of the year. And as if that weren't enough, now it's been nominated for Best Animated Feature at the Oscars and is hotly tipped to add that little gold guy to the Golden Globe it won last month and the Grammy it picked up just last night for Best Song Written for Visual Media for, yes, you guessed it, Golden. And at the centre of this golden era of success are the film's co-writer-director duo, Maggie Kang and Chris Appelhans. When they came to London recently, our Alex Godfrey, who has watched the film about 1,000 times thanks to his young daughter, jumped at the chance to talk to them both about how the little film that could became the big film that has. But there was only one question that he could possibly ask to kick things off. Here it is. Enjoy.
Maggie Kang and Chris Appelhans, welcome to the Empire Podcast. Where are you today?
We're in the Netflix London office.
Yeah.
My first question is basically, what the hell is going on? Because
that's what we're at.
I imagine my daughter is 5 and she discovered the film when it came out. What was it? August, I think?
June.
Oh, my God. She found it in the summer, July or August, and I hadn't heard of it. So she took it and her mum, they brought it to me. And then it was already starting to filter through. But very, very quickly became the biggest thing on the planet. But genuinely, like, it's genuinely the biggest thing on planet. And it has been for a while. I mean, Netflix's most watched movie ever, number one album, number one single for ages. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that so before the summer the world at large just didn't even know about it, right? And you've been working on it for years, Maggie, what, maybe a decade ish
like seven years,
right? And so you worked on it for 7 years and then suddenly it is everywhere, like every day. It's just permeated every facet of pop culture. This must just feel like a parallel universe to you, what's going on with this. I mean, I know people say, did you ever expect something to get this big? Obviously, you would have had no idea that it would have exploded like this. But what does it feel like? Because it must be really surreal.
It is. It's very surreal. It's weird. It's like you have this idea for so long and you work on something for so long and is finally out there and you're just happy that people are seeing what you've been working on. But you never expect this scale of, this is just massive. I honestly didn't know that a movie could do this.
Yeah.
It was just,
we had a moment where we're like, this is like the first 2 or 3 weeks, we felt like we had to be everywhere and see everything and every comment and every response. And then like after a few weeks, it was overwhelming and we're like, oh, this is like,
this is too big.
It's like a kid. Like, you just have to let it go out in the world and
live its
life.
Don't
have to be there for all of it. Like, just let it be itself. So that's kind of what we're trying to do.
Well, it's interesting. You just said, Maggie, you didn't even know a movie could do this. Well, they don't. Movies don't do this.
Yeah. I don't think I've seen this before. So I didn't even know this was possible.
It's not. It's not usually possible. I mean, it's unholy what's going on. It's so, so big. And also, so through my daughter, I lost count of how many times I've watched it. You know, it's different when you have a kid and watching it all the time. And she is, I'm not joking. She's getting up in the morning at 7 a.m. invariably. This is what she wants. And, you know, and sometimes when she comes home as well, I do the school run every morning and sometimes in the afternoon. Cannot get in the car without her asking for how it's done. Yeah. and then Golden and what it just.
My son is 5 and he's in the bathtub singing about how he sees beauty in the broken glass. And I'm like, okay, whatever that means to you.
My daughter is 5 and she's quoting Rambo because Rambo is referenced in, you know, there. That's quite disturbing. But so, I mean, for me, through my daughter, I am just seeing, and I have very quickly grown to love it as much as she does, if not more. You know, it's gone past the point now where I sometimes get in the car on my own and putting on Golden. No, it is. So she's 5. I've got friends with teenage daughters, 14, 15, 16, 17, and sons, you know, and that there is, it's rare to find a film that succeeds on this level, but also that cuts through demographically, you know, age, culture, everything. And I guess that's just testament to the work, not just the work you put into it, but that the quality control on every level of this film, you know, narratively, visually, lyrically, the production, the song production, everything. I just can't imagine how much work you and everyone who worked on it put into it to get everything so right. And I guess that as artists, that's what you try to do every time. But what you've achieved here seems to. Sorry, this is just going to be half an hour of me telling you how.
I know, I love this.
Yeah, more.
But you know, it's just it's an emotional film. It's a dramatic film. It's funny. It's quite illuminating in terms of the culture as well. You know, you're opening up Korean culture to people who don't know. Some people who don't know anything about it, especially kids. And you know, the songs are just permeating all the time. When did you? Well, has it been a constant realization of just as it's been growing that it's just hitting more and more and more people on every level?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, you kind of watch it travel out. I mean, great credit to like that core audience, like the first 2 weeks of people who found it and made their own TikToks about it. They were like the best marketing you could ever ask for because they'd make mashups. And then that, however it works, traveled from them to parents, to kids, to, you know, my parents who are very old and live in the middle of nowhere in Idaho. So when they heard about it from their neighbors, I'm like, whoa, we made it all the way.
Well, that's what's really interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, I won't get into the weeds too much, but when a film is so quickly beloved like this one is, and, you know, there obviously has been some talk of people saying, oh, well, you know, this should have been released, you know, should have been a cinema release. But you know, the world has changed, and I cannot see that this film would have caught fire in the way that it has if it had just been a theatrical release, because people found it, they discovered it themselves, they told their friends about it, the family started watching it, and they were immediately all watching it again and again and again and again. It's been a word of mouth success of the like that I can't compare it to anything else. And that is in large part due to the fact that it was freely available to people with Netflix subscriptions on their TV sets. And then obviously it has subsequently been put out in the cinemas and watched by, I think, including me and my family, by people who have already seen it countless times on. Yeah. There is nothing like this. You know, before this, my daughter had Frozen, and Frozen is still a big thing, but there's just something else about it. And when I did take her to see that's what I'm getting confused about. August was when I took her to see it in the cinema to the sing-along.
Wow.
Right, that's when we went to cinema. Obviously, it'd been around a couple of months before that. But I'd got her a Huntrix t-shirt, official Netflix merch. and she was psyched to go and see it in the cinema. She wore her t-shirt, and I was standing there with her in the lobby, and she was so excited to see it in the cinema because I said, there's going to be other boys and girls there. You're all allowed to get up and sing along. The word's going to be on the screen. And she was there in her t-shirt. And I thought, I saw Star Wars when I was 4 and in the cinema, and it had a massive effect on my life and is responsible for better or worse for many of my life choices since then. And seeing her there in the cinema being really excited and wearing that t-shirt, I thought, well, this is that generation's Star Wars. You know, this is that film that is having that impact on them. And it's got all that stuff in there. It's a fantasy film. It's exciting. It's got good guys and bad guys. It's got that really beefy mythology. It's got that influence of all different sort of cultures, which is what George Lucas put into Star Wars as well, in a way. And I wondered if that sort of thing was on your mind when you were working on it, if you were hoping for that sort of cut through in that way and for that sort of impact, or were you just sort of locked inside the bubble of just trying to get it right?
Yeah, I think it was the latter. We just wanted to make something great. We wanted to make something we'd always wanted to see.
Yeah.
As younger versions of ourselves, but also now, mm-hmm. and as filmmakers and people who have watched a lot of these things and wanted to see something we haven't seen. And we just wanted to, like you said, like perfect it. We didn't let go of anything until we were like 100% satisfied with it. And there's, I don't know about you, but I have small, tiny, like, oh, I wish we did that, but really no regrets at all with mm-hmm. what the movie is. And just very, very proud of it and happy with it. And so we just hoped that people would like it too, because we loved it.
Yeah. Well, what was it like, Maggie? You said you worked on it for 7 years. You know, you've worked on one of the Lego movies, you worked on Kung Fu Panda 3, I think. You worked all sorts of things. What was it like working on other people's projects mm-hmm. while you had your own very personal passion project sort of bubbling under beyond that? At the same time,
you know, I don't think it was really bubbling under there for a long time. It wasn't like I wanted to make something for that long. I knew that I wanted to eventually get to a place where I wanted to tell my version of a personal story, and I knew that I wanted to see Korean culture represented on screen, but it wasn't like I had this in me for a really long time before it was bought by Sony and developed. It was
okay.
I'm just kind of trained to come up with ideas. And so when I was approached by a producer at Sony asking, hey, the producer who produced Wish Dragon wanted a very similar experience because he loved working on that film so much. And he asked if I had an idea that was more international perspective, and I said, of course I do. And even though I didn't have anything, and so it was, you know, as a creator, you're always constantly thinking about elements of stuff and not really a full, it's not always like a full concept.
Yeah.
And I had a few things and just put them together: Korean demons, Korean culture, these types of women, female characters, and got this demon hunter idea. And then the K-pop was kind of added in last as like, oh, it needs more flourish, doesn't feel like enough of a concept. And it was another Korean element, and at the time BTS was, I don't think they were kind of at their peak yet, but they were like peaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so it felt like just a good element to add in, and it felt weird but different and exciting when that mashed up against demon hunting.
Yeah.
And then literally the next day it was pitched like very words. Yeah, with like 6 words to a producer over brunch, and he was like, I love this, let's do it. And that's kind of how it went. And so it was after it was pitched and bought that I really dug in and tried to figure it out. It wasn't like I had thought about this for years before that.
Okay.
Although yeah. I think you've explained it well in that, like, we're both worked in the industry for 20 years, 15 years, and you're you're accumulating skills, but you're also like, you're like also collecting feelings and ideas that might not even be, you don't even understand that they're related to this idea, but like Maggie's talked about, like wanting a certain type of comedic female character and kind of having a lot of the movies you were working on sort of rejecting that, which you don't realize in that moment is shaping you as a storyteller eventually until finally you get your chance and you're like, well, here it goes.
Yeah.
Here's the thing I've been holding.
Yeah, I could do the thing that I wanted to do. There's one thing that I've never done, but I've looked.
That's.
There's ideas that you kind of accumulate that you're like, oh, I want to do this kind of thing. Yeah. And when you get that opportunity, you just, you do it.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's, yeah, I mean, that speaks to the success of this film, that it does feel new, but in a sense also it's doing things that people have maybe wanted to see for so long without really maybe even knowing that they wanted to see it because of the way that we've been fed. Certainly, yes. Traditionally, before that, I mean, it's really interesting what you just said about you've been wanting to do, you know, funny female characters and not being given the chance. So what were your experiences there? Were you creating things and people were just saying, we don't do that?
There was one instance where we had, we have so many meetings in animation with female characters. And because, you know, if we have a group of characters, we usually just get one female character and all male, and we run into an issue of like, we have all these meetings about how do we make this female character pop. That's always the word, pop. And in one film I suggested, well, why don't we take the funniest male character and just swap it with the female character so she's the funniest. And there was just silence in the room, and they were like not going for it. And I just thought, well, that was my pitch, and I thought that was a great idea, but that nobody went for that. And so, you know, just having gone through that, it kind of accumulates, and you think like, well, if I'm going to do a movie about women, I'm just going to make them really weird and super funny, and just to prove a point that female characters can be that. And I feel like we've seen that in live action movies, like with Bridesmaids and like just everything that Kristen Wiig does.
Pen 13.
Yes. Yeah. A show that we referenced a lot.
Yeah.
But we were just not seeing that in animation, and it was just really frustrating.
Yeah. It's weird. Cause my wife she's an author, and she's like a early Korean American writing voice in young adult. And she writes like these funny, weird characters. And she's always hounding me, like, why are you not making more interesting female characters in animation?
Yeah.
So the time I sat down with Maggie and she's like, I want to do these girls that are like really awesome and really weird. It was like, yeah, there is a pent up demand for this. Like so many people are.
I also don't even think weird is really the right word. It's just, they're just
real.
Real?
Yeah.
They're not, they're just.
They're all the things.
Themselves.
Yeah.
And. We're not, I don't know, it's just, it's a different, they're just bare. It's just, and that was very important for us. And to the point where we wanted to show all aspects of women and
tech.
And we also did a bare makeup, bare face look with no makeup. They were just not made. They had like not even filled in eyebrows and some bags under their eyes, redness. And that was very important for me to show because, and then the other side of it, really, really good makeup, because I feel like both of those have not been shown in animation. And so we worked really hard to really hone in on that. And then also the fashion, there's so many aspects of this movie that I feel like we just haven't seen on female characters. Really great fashion, nail art, like all these details that women really appreciate. And then the flip side of that, which is the bare makeup and pajama pants, lame, tacky pajamas, which is also an aspect of women that a lot of people get to see, but we don't see represented.
Yeah, it's amazing. And they're pop stars. It's really interesting that you said the K-pop element came in late, because what is brilliant about the music and the songs in this film, that they are not only a fundamental, but an inseparable part of the narrative. These songs drive the story forward and drive character with every beat, with every line. And so and they stop and they start. And, you know, sometimes the songs stop while something happens.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated to know how you made that work in terms of working with the singers and the songwriters. And I know, you know, and some were both. Were they part of the script process at all? Because it seemed, like I say, it's completely inseparable and it's such a smooth, fluid job.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a really intense collaboration. We were writing kind of launch documents. We were writing scripts really for every song to kick the songwriters off, in which we were, without the poetry of a pop lyric, we were telling as if we were writing a scene. What's the meaning and the purpose of this verse and this pre-chorus and this chorus and all the same high standards you would hold to writing a good scene, you put it into the song.
Yeah.
And then try to also provide the songwriter with a kind of pop parallel. So maybe a song like, I don't know, Takedown is, story-wise, it's this double act of like sort of a catharsis of like saying how crappy the Soja Boys are, which is all triggering to Rumi because deception and demon, all that is part of what she's hiding. And then at the same time, we'd be like, but really this should feel like a song where like your boyfriend that you broke up with, you know, he's a total jerk and you can't wait for the rest of the world to find out what an a-hole he is. So I was always trying to balance that, like almost a sort of pedantic specific thing for the subtext of the songs, but never say that, never actually say the way musical theater will just declare a thing. We're like, let's do the metaphoric version and then it stays pop.
But we were the writers, so yeah. we had full control of the story.
Yeah.
And so we were writing the script, but the music was all just part of the writing as well. It was just, we were now going into song.
Yeah.
And the music had just more, I guess, more dense storytelling that it needed to carry. And so we worked with our executive music producer, who's also very great at story. He comes from a musical Broadway background. And so he would grill us on like, what does this song, what does it have to say? Like, what does it need to say about the characters? What does it need to say about this moment? What story role is it playing? So it was very tough. It was really, because we would abandon story things, problems, because they were too hard to figure out. We're like, okay, let's go to music. And then we go to music and then we'd have to confront that story problem because we have to address it in order to get the music written.
Yeah, it's like, the music meeting became a story meeting again. No. Yeah.
So it was just double story meetings and just more intense because just the songs just were just, I don't know, just condensed story things.
Yeah. And we tried, the other thing I think became a guiding principle was people don't just break into song. That there's always a context for them, whether it's releasing a single or even in the duet scene, which is sort of your most conventional West Side Story duet. But even there, Rumi is trying to regain her voice, and she's actually testing out her voice while she's sort of progressing the relationship. So always having reason for the song felt like it made it different.
Well, also tonally, you know, the Huntrix songs are so heartfelt and empowering and dramatic and vulnerable. And the Sarge Boys songs are like empty bubblegum boy band pop. Yeah. And not just like, let's have a song for this guy and let's have a song for this guy and let's, you know, let's give this person a chance to sing a song. They are such keen observations on, you know, different types of pop music, and you use them in a way that serves your characters. It's just it's really nuanced. That was that something that you wanted to do from the start?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We wanted those to be essentially manipulations and emotionally at its core, kind of emotionally either deceptive or kind of abusive. Like your idol is it's a total banger. And it's also, when you stop to think about the lyrics, it's like a really toxic relationship that you're being beckoned into. Yeah. And we wanted to make sure that that was a reflection of Kima, whose whole philosophy as a villain is that the secrets and the shame that you have are things that make you unworthy of love and only, you know,
yeah,
come to come to me where you can be consumed, but that was really his song in a way.
But really, like, with all the songs, except for the last song that the girls sing, which is the most vulnerable song, it's just everything is put out there. Mm-hmm. All of the songs have dual meaning. Even how it's done, it's a triumphant declaration of who they are as pop stars, but then there is that kind of underlying, we are the latest iteration of these hunters, this legacy that's been passed down through centuries, and that's just kind of snuck in there.
Soulful underpinning, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everything, all the songs have dual meaning, except for the last one, which is the most meaningful thing. And yeah. That's their journey, is that they have to shed all of that, I guess, a facade and just be real.
It's incredibly emotional. I read an interesting interview with Audrey Nuna, who does she do Mira? Is she Mira's voice?
Yeah.
So she was being asked about the music, and I remember when I first started, when these songs really started to get under my skin, even when I first started hearing them, I remember hearing How It's Done, and the first couple of times, and I was like, oh, this kind of sounds like a Katy Perry song. Oh no, now it sounds like a Bollywood song. Oh, now it's like K-pop. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting, because it's all over the place, but it works as a whole. But you can sort of feel all the different influences and infiltration, which I think is, you know, which is just how music evolves over time and how pop music assimilates all sorts of styles and cultures. And so then sometime after that, I read this interview with her, and she was talking about the fact that that's sort of going on. And she said, I think genre is dead in a sense. And I thought that was really interesting, and it definitely applies to some of these songs. And also, I think it speaks to this film as a whole, because it is a bit of a melting pot, isn't it? Would you agree with that? And where does that come from? Is that sort of just emblematic of the point that we've sort of got to in culture?
Well, I mean, the origins of K-pop is that it is like a mix of genres. So the guy who is kind of coined as the godfather of K-pop, he actually comes from a heavy metal background. So if you listen to his music, there's a lot of like heavy metal influences, and not even influences, just full country. Yeah. And he's the one that also brought rap into Korea. And so there's a lot of hip hop influences. So he just mixed everything. You would just like switch it up right in the middle of the movie and then switch it again. And it really fits our movie, because tonally we wanted to do that. We wanted to achieve that as well. We were really big fans of Bong Joon-ho, and the host, especially, is something that we both like connected with, because he's just constantly switching up tone over and over again and putting total opposites next to each other, and just makes it work. And we wanted to try that in this. And so I think it really suited like just our movie, and also just how our characters are. We wanted to show very silly girls, but also really vulnerable, but also pop stars, very cool. And so I think the entire movie is just this hodgepodge of things. And we found that very exciting. We just wanted this to be a huge experience.
Even launching the songs, mm-hmm. like pulling, we obviously had a lot of K-pop references when we were giving them direction on the vibe of the song, but there's Kate Bush and Bill Withers and Kanye and FK Twigs and Iggy, like just, which is the beauty of how K-pop is so, so acrobatic and mm-hmm. so open to like influences. And
because it could be kind of taken as like just pop music. It's not artistic, but there's actually tons of artistry that needs to go into that. And
the
production value of it is very specific.
The skill is crazy.
The skill level is really crazy. So,
You know, the Huntrix girls, like the real singers were on Jimmy Fallon's show, singing Golden. It must be amazing for you to sort of have that fourth wall be obliterated, because like Huntrix is almost like a real band now.
it's really wild. It was just a dream 7 years ago, and I remember just being in Spring Asper's office, the president of Sony Music, with Christine Belson, the president of Sony Animation, and just talking about just how do we build this group? Like,
yeah.
And we talked about, you know, do we assemble like a superstar group with existing artists? And it didn't feel right. Like we wanted, my dream was just to create an original band, like a new group of unknown or relatively unknowns and create this group.
Yeah.
And it feels like we really did that. Yeah. And even when, and that's something that we worried about a lot. Even when the film came out, we wondered how long it would take or if it was possible for the audience to just accept these women as
the stars,
these characters as stars and not fictional characters. And immediately it just happened. It was like, I love Rumi. I'm Rumi. I'm a Zoe. I'm a Mira. And because it happened so quickly, we were like, whoa, okay, where do we go from here? And it just made leaps and strides.
I think it also, it speaks to the timeliness. Like when Maggie told me about this idea, that one of the things that struck me was just like how overdue it, because this, I think good original ideas that are sort of having their time, they have this kind of, they like extract from the universe the things they need. And so as we're casting voices and singers and songwriters, people like EJ and Audrey and Ray, they are here and they're talented. They need a platform. Yeah. The movie is a platform to showcase this talent that's like waiting for their moment.
Yeah.
So that feels really, that's a sign that you are making a film that's like, you know, it's time. It's the right time for that story.
Yeah, 100%. Okay, well, I've got time for one more question. I just want to go back to the start. I was comparing this to Star Wars in terms of the mythology, and I think it's also got the potential and the scope that Star Wars has always had. I mean, Star Wars is nearly 50 years old and still growing and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And obviously there has been talk of sequels for this and spin-offs and, you know, further stories concentrating, giving the spotlight to different members of the band. I heard rumors of maybe a potential stage show, but how do you see it? Do you think that there is scope here for you, for this Demon Hunters world to branch and spin off and spiral and sort of grow beyond the story you've told? Where do you see it going?
There's definitely room. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're probably going to be really cagey here about what you can or can't say, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I can see you go.
I mean, I think it'd be a missed opportunity to not do that. So, because there's just so much potential for it.
And it's great to hear the way everyone has understood and embraced everything that we thought the story was saying, spoken or a subtext, everything we wanted to imply, that the sort of perfect way that hit the audience. I feel like it makes us excited because we were just making the story that we believed in and writing the characters that we wanted to write.
Yeah.
And so then it feels like, okay, we just keep writing the stories that we want to tell and that wherever that takes it, the audience will follow.
Yeah. Well, there's a moral to that story. Congrats on the film and its success. And I can't wait to see what comes next. And thanks for talking to me today.
Thank you.
It's really
fun.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay. That was Alex Godfrey talking to Maggie Kang and Chris Applehands, directors of K-pop Demon Hunters. Glorious stuff. And that's it for this interview special. There will be more interviews coming your way this week in the new regular episode called simply The Interviews and on the Mothership podcast, which is out every Friday and also features Team Empire talking about movies when we're not fighting demons, that is. Right. That's enough from me. I'm going up, up, up. It's my moment. You know, together we're glowing. Gonna be golden. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.